Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. Welcome to the show. Some housekeeping. First, huge congratulations to Sohail Kakavand and the team at Casa Cornelius San Diego on the unpublished win in Sanchez Argueta v. Garland issued 2 weeks ago. And thanks for asking me to help out with Moot. You did great, Sohail. Dare I say, ask for publication? Next, after my discussion last week of the Thigulas, one longtime loyal listener in the know wrote to remind me that as bad as their delay might be, any qualifying derivative children that they have who filed applications to adjust status with their parents will not likely be aging out due to USCIS's administrative hold policy. See, under that policy, even if we don't want to call it a policy, the adjustment of status applications are still considered pending by USCIS, and they will be considered pending for years, which therefore means that the children should be protected from aging out under the Child Status Protection Act, even if they become much older than 21 years old in real life. So that's good, and at least it's something that USCIS did under these absurd, delayed circumstances. Thank you, listener. As to me, well, the circuits whooped my butt on Friday, and now it is a 9-case week. Settle in. Interesting, as always. Our first case is Anor v. Garland, published by the Fourth Circuit on March 15th, 2024. A Friday case. Welcome back to the podcast, Ben Winograd, and congrats yet again on your win, O'Grad. How many times can I use that joke before it gets stale? Because if the threshold is when it stops amusing me, well, it will be a long time for us all. This case is about particularly serious crimes. Mr. Noor is from Ghana, and he came to the United States as an LPR seemingly when his father became a lawful permanent resident. It seems like he was doing well and giving back to his community, but in 2017, a colleague of his asked him to funnel money through his company, that is, Mr. Noor's, to a friend, Stephen Antwi. Quote, over the next few years, Antwi and Anor handled money procured through a romance fraud scheme in which members of the conspiracy made false romantic advances online to induce victims, many of whom were isolated or elderly, to send the conspirators money. Over a period of 3 years, the conspiracy swindled more than $6.2 million from over 200 victims across the United States, end quote. Big yikes, as the kids say. For what it's worth, explained the Fourth Circuit, Mr. Noor was only a middleman who sent the proceeds to fraudsters in Ghana. It all came crashing down in a conspiracy to commit money laundering conviction in May 2021. That's 18 U.S.C. Section 1956H. And it's a per se aggravated felony under INA Section 11843D, given the amount of loss, which makes it a per se particularly serious crime that bars asylum. But Mr. Noor only got sentenced to 36 months imprisonment, so it's not a per se aggravated felony for withholding of removal purposes. That would have required at least 5 years imprisonment. Mr. Noor conceded his removability in the removal proceedings that followed, and he applied for withholding of removal and Convention Against Torture Protection. Quote, he based his claims of persecution and torture on his fear of retaliation by the Ghana-based Land Guards, a mercenary militia that had orchestrated the romance fraud scheme and allegedly knew of Mr. Enor's cooperation with United States prosecutors. End quote. Not for nothing, it seems like that cooperation may have been what allowed Mr. Enor to avoid the per se withholding of removal, particularly serious crime. The IJ denied withholding under the INA and Convention Against Torture based on a finding that the conviction was a particularly serious crime, even though it wasn't violent in nature, and even though it didn't have the 5 years imprisonment. Still possible, of course, if an IJ deems the crime particularly serious by applying the framework outlined in the BIA's 2007 decision matter of NAM. Cat deferral was denied on the merits, as there is no bar to that, and the BIA affirmed. The Fourth Circuit disagreed. Recall, the particularly serious crime analysis, when not per se, is a case-by-case inquiry and requires consideration, at least in the Fourth Circuit, of 1. The nature of the conviction, 2. The circumstances and underlying facts of the conviction, 3. The type of sentence imposed, and quote, most importantly, end quote, 4. Whether the type and circumstances of the crime indicate that the non-citizen will be a danger to the community. Now, as I understand it, and as the IJ in this case analyzed, there is a threshold finding required that the criminal statute itself fall within the ambit of being a particularly serious crime. Restated, it probably doesn't matter what you do during the act. If you get convicted only of simple trespassing, it's probably never going to be a particularly serious crime, because that's not the type of crime that can fall within the ambit of particularly serious ones. Also, matter of BZR permits consideration of mental health factors where present, even though they're not present here. There. That's our legal landscape. First, said the Fourth Circuit, both the IJ and the BIA failed to properly analyze the elements of a conspiracy to commit money laundering offense. They didn't properly look at the elements of the statute. And let me tell you, as someone who recently did a deep dive into both sections 1956 and 1957, I sympathize. But not doing so for the agency was error, said the Fourth Circuit. After all, how else would you be able to know whether, quote, the elements of the offense potentially bring the crime into a category of particularly serious crimes, end quote, that initial inquiry? Because again, if the elements are not, quote, the individual facts and circumstances of the offense are of no consequence, end quote. Highlighting the importance of step-by-step analyses and how it all sometimes can be the non-citizen bar's best friend. Restated, only if the elements could possibly make a crime particularly serious can you look at what the facts are to see if it actually was. Not so dissimilar to the categorical approach, right? The particularly serious crime analysis is not just a free-for-all of looking at a crime's facts and circumstances. All this is consistent with prior Fourth Circuit precedent and recent precedent out of the Second and Third Circuit, among others. Plus, it's how I've always read matter of NAM. The IJ messed up here, explained the court, listing, for example, loss amount as an element. But it's not. It's just loss amount. A conspiracy to commit money laundering conviction lies where the money at issue is far less than $6 million. The BIA didn't make this same mistake, but apparently it, quote, analyzed the elements of the wrong statute altogether, end quote. Not a great look. Seems like instead of looking at Section 1956H conspiracy, the BIA analyzed a substantive Section 1957 money laundering offense. And there are many subsections there, but that was error. And it's material, as the Section 1957 offense that the BIA looked to requires proof that, quote, the defendant knowingly participated in a monetary transaction involving criminally derived proceeds, end quote. In contrast, a Section 1956H conspiracy, quote, requires nothing more than an agreement to launder money, end quote. It's not nearly as bad. All important here because, quote, without question, there is a significant difference between agreeing to an illicit monetary transaction and personally carrying it out, end quote. Regardless of what Mr. Anor did, the former is what he was actually convicted of. The Fourth Circuit rejected all of the government's counterarguments, which I'll touch briefly because it's a very long episode. It's not the case, for example, that a conspiracy to commit money laundering conviction includes as an element the elements of a substantive money laundering offense. There is no overt act showing for a money laundering conspiracy, explained the court. And yes, matter of NAM does indeed require this two-step process, the initial elements-based showing before getting to the facts. Pin this case to remind the adjudicators in the future for your clients. Quote, NAM clearly provides that the individual facts and circumstances of the offense are of no consequence if the elements do not qualify, instructing that the elements must be evaluated before the facts may be considered, end quote. The Fourth Circuit does not believe that any circuit has held otherwise. Not only that, explained the court, but the BIA erred at, quote, the second step of NAM when it failed to consider whether Mr. Anor's money laundering conspiracy conviction indicates that he poses a danger to the community, end quote. The reason that Attorney General Garland's matter of BZR decision permits consideration of mental health evidence at this stage is because this danger to the community analysis is actually more than simply an analysis of the crime. Yes, the crime is the focal point, but only to the extent that it indicates that a non-citizen is dangerous. The IJ and the BIA actually didn't conduct this more nuanced analysis, and so they erred. That being said, if the conviction is of the type to make it particularly serious, such that the facts can be considered, and we don't know yet, the matter of NAM analysis does permit consideration of, quote, the fraudulent actions of co-conspirators, end quote. It is a conspiracy crime, after all, explained the Fourth Circuit. We'll see if we can even get there on remand. What a case. And by the way, the first footnote indicates that there was quite the argument over venue, including the interplay between recent Fourth Circuit and Third Circuit precedent and BIA decisions, which would have been very confusing, but it was ultimately avoided to the great benefit of both me and you all, the podcast's loyal listeners. And it all means, along with Ben, congrats to lots of great attorneys from Capital Area Immigrants Rights Coalition, CARE, and the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, or RACES, out of San Antonio. Great win, guys. And that is Anor V. Garland. I hope you enjoyed that win. Because next we have Vasquez Castaneda v. Perry et al., published by the Fourth Circuit on March 13th, 2024. And as good as that last Fourth Circuit decision was for non-citizen, this one is just as bad. It's a big bummer of a loss litigated by great attorneys. This case is about prolonged detention. Which means it's an exceptionally long one, and it's why I don't always do them. Mr. Vasquez Castaneda is from El Salvador, was ordered removed in or about 2006, and he was physically removed 2 years later. He re-entered the United States unlawfully. In May 2016, the International Criminal Police Organization, known as Interpol, published a request to law enforcement worldwide, known as a Red Notice, to locate and provisionally arrest him for extradition to El Salvador. Quote, the Red Notice, which was predicated on an arrest warrant issued by the Salvadoran government in 2010, alleged that Mr. Vasquez Castaneda was an MS-13 gang member and had been charged with aggravated murder and criminal conspiracy based on his involvement in a fatal shooting in April 2009, end quote. No idea whether that's all true or not. I will stop to note that, one, the Department of Justice recognizes that red notices do not equate to probable cause that a crime was committed abroad, and two, precedent exists undermining the reliability of Salvadoran red notices. Now, back to our regularly scheduled case. DHS apprehended Mr. Vasquez Castaneda and reinstated that final order of removal. He, however, claimed a fear of return to El Salvador, as is his right, and it was deemed reasonable. DHS placed him in withholding-only proceedings, where he could apply only for withholding of removal and protection under the Convention Against Torture. Another aside. Due to the Fourth Circuit's recent devastating decision for non-citizens in Martinez v. Garland, episode 186, I believe Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda can't get review of the substance of the IJ and BIA's denial of his withholding of removal and CAT claims if he ultimately loses any petitions for review. Pretty nuts. Anyway, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda requested a bond hearing before an immigration judge in August 2019. He had, after all, apparently been living in the U.S. for years without harming anyone. More importantly, this was consistent with precedent at the time that expressly permitted people like Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda to get bond hearings in the Fourth Circuit. That's the Guzman-Chavez decision out of the Fourth Circuit. But as the court explains here, the Supreme Court overturned Guzman-Chavez in 2021 directly, episode 62. That means that today, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda wouldn't be guaranteed a bond hearing in immigration court. But in any event, he did get that bond hearing way back when. But an IJ deemed him a danger to the community because of the red notice and wouldn't allow his release. Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda did not appeal that to the BIA. And wouldn't you know it, following a couple of continuances, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda won his case before the IJ on the merits. The IJ granted CAT protection. But as we've been seeing a bit on the pod of late from 2020, DHS decided to appeal, and the BIA remanded, believing the IJ had erred in finding that Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda was credible. No small thing to happen. Undeterred, the IJ granted CAT protection again. Undeterred, DHS appealed again. Undeterred, the BIA remanded again, quote, on factual inconsistencies in the IJ's decision concerning Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda's continued membership in MS-13, end quote. Deterred, the IJ denied nearly a year later. With the case having now been remanded twice, and despite hearing lots of testimony those first two times, the IJ now believed that Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda, quote, remained affiliated with MS-13, and therefore faced no risk of torture at the gang's hands if returned to El Salvador, end quote. And now we're 2.5 years post that initial bond denial. And oh my god, quote, this time, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda appealed, and in August 2023, the BIA yet again vacated the IJ's decision, concluding that the IJ failed to engage with new evidence submitted by Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda and remanded the case for a third time. The IJ has yet to rule on remand, end quote. Doing the math then, that's over 4.5 years in immigration detention, post-bond hearing, as of the date of this recording, during the entirety of a whole pandemic, wherein people died in ICE detention. So Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda filed a habeas action in federal court demanding his release. And to be honest, other than the MS-13 stuff, which isn't so relevant to a habeas action, it seems like this is the perfect case, procedurally, for such a claim. In addition to the 4.5 years of detention that Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda has spent, ICE has conducted multiple custody reviews as mandated by ICE's regulations, but every time comes to the same conclusion. Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda is a danger and a flight risk. Which is what you'd expect the prosecuting agency to likely keep concluding, which is why judicial review of detention, where both parties appear before a court as equals, is so important when liberty is on the line. Particularly as ICE's, quote, custody determination did not change, even after Interpol rescinded the red notice concerning Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda in November of 2019, end quote. So he's not even subject to a red notice anymore. Recall, technically all of this is happening post-final order of removal. Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda's removal order became final in the mid-2000s the first time, and it's now been reinstated. That he's seeking withholding of removal and CAT protection doesn't make that removal order any less final. And this is particularly the case in the Fourth Circuit, given the court's rationale in Martinez v. Garland. His habeas lawsuit alleged that his prolonged detention violated INA Section 241 as interpreted by the Supreme Court's decision in Zadvydas, which held that Section 241 authorizes detention only, quote, until it has been determined that there is no significant likelihood of removal in the reasonably foreseeable future, end quote. Second, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda asserted that his prolonged detention without a bond hearing, at least, violated the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. This is the perfect case, in the perfect circuit for this issue. And yet, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda did not succeed before the District Court or the Fourth Circuit. See, according to the court's rational reading of the Supreme Court's precedent, in order to violate Section 241, as interpreted by Zadvydas, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda must first show that, quote, his removal was not likely to occur within the reasonably foreseeable future, end quote. And despite three BIA remands, and to be fair, it was only two when the district court judge ruled, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda could not make that initial showing here. Quote, the district court emphasized both the finite nature of withholding-only proceedings and the fact that ICE routinely deports non-citizens to El Salvador, end quote. In any event, on the merits, the district court believed that ICE's evidence on flight risk and danger justified continued detention. Despite, again, there no longer existing a red notice, which isn't probable cause that a crime was committed, anyway. The due process claim, in turn, is governed by the three-factor balancing test set out in Matthews v. Eldridge from 1976. At least in the Fourth Circuit and most, if not all, circuits, judges must weigh a non-citizen's strong interest in liberty against the government's interest of deporting people and ensuring public safety. The district court believed it all weighed in the government's favor here, particularly given ICE's periodic reviews of Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda's bond eligibility. As I mentioned, the Fourth Circuit affirmed the district court. But I mean, hey, at least the Fourth Circuit didn't say that he didn't have a claim. He does. He can bring his Zadvydas-based and due process-based challenges. Kind of. The court just didn't see grounds for overturning the district court. Zadvydas is largely premised on the fact that INA Section 241A requires that DHS detain and remove non-citizens during the 90 days post-removal order. That 90 days expired a long time ago here, in the mid-2000s. The statute doesn't have an exception for withholding-only proceedings, nor does it require detention during withholding-only proceedings post-reinstatement, or at least post-90 days following reinstatement, depending on how you're reading it. The post-removal order statute does, however, authorize DHS, quote, to detain a non-citizen beyond the removal period in certain circumstances, including where the non-citizen is inadmissible or DHS determines that the non-citizen is a risk to the community or unlikely to comply with the order of removal, end quote. The problem with all this is that DHS often reasons that a non-citizen in withholding-only proceedings is unlikely to comply with another removal order if he or she loses. And DHS doesn't really ever explain its conclusion on that. It really doesn't have to under its periodic review regulations. And the statute doesn't require release after 90 days. But again, the Supreme Court reasoned in Zadvydas that anything over 6 months was presumptively unreasonable. And that passed over 4 years ago in this case, that presumption of unreasonableness. So then, what does presumptively unreasonable detention from Zadvydas really mean if it doesn't result in release here? Well, again, for that Zadvydas showing explained the Fourth Circuit, Mr. Vasquez-Castaneda must show himself that there is, quote, good reason to believe that there is no significant likelihood of removal in the reasonably foreseeable future, end quote. And if that can't be met here, three remands in and awaiting a fourth decision by an IJ, then I fail to see how any withholding of removal applicant can meet that burden. And it was not met here. The Fourth Circuit explained that in Zadvydas, DHS couldn't find a country to accept the petitioners, and so they decided to just keep them detained. Perhaps they were former Soviet Union people? I haven't read that decision in a bit. To the Fourth Circuit, though, quoting its recent precedent, quote, the clear takeaway from the Supreme Court's decisions in DeMoor and Jennings is that Zadvydas should not be expanded beyond the context of the indefinite and potentially permanent detention involved there, end quote. Emphasis by the court. And man, is that a high bar. No matter how protracted, explained the Fourth Circuit, withholding-only proceedings are finite. They'll end, eventually. When? Unclear. But that's good enough for the Fourth Circuit. Quote, stated differently, ongoing withholding-only proceedings do not, standing alone, cast doubt on the foreseeability of a non-citizen's removal in the future. End quote. This is sometimes just how litigation goes, explained the Fourth Circuit in a footnote. Court also explains how this decision aligns with that of some other circuits. Pretty rough. But what about due process? The due process claim doesn't require the now near impossible to meet, no reasonable likelihood of removal initial showing. It's just application of the Matthews balancing test. And here's where the Fourth Circuit really came out with the killer holding. The Fourth Circuit reads Zadvydas correctly as a decision that was about constitutional avoidance. Supreme Court believed that without a safety valve, a statute like Section 241 that might permit indefinite detention might be unconstitutional. So it made Section 241A constitutional. It created this safety valve framework that I just described. Never mind that the Fourth Circuit has just severely narrowed the applicability of the safety valve. It still exists, technically. And so, quote, in other words, the Zadvydas standard is due process. A Section 241 detainee who fails the Zadvydas test fails to prove a due process claim, end quote. The safety valve, in effect, is what protects due process. I feel like I literally just got punched in the face, and I can hear the wails of habeas practitioners nationwide. And I mean that sentence in the oratory, aquatic mammalian, and geographic sense. Sorry, I gotta give myself something to smile about on this one. To be fair, all of that due process stuff seems like it might be dicta that this Fourth Circuit panel hopes that oil might seize upon next time around. Because oil conceded that an as-applied due process challenge was actually viable in this case. So did he get due process? Well, quote, the only reason Mr. Vasquez Castaneda finds himself in continued detention is because he voluntarily initiated withholding-only proceedings, blocking his prompt removal from the United States, end quote. To the court, there's been no showing that the government has acted in bad faith, plus Mr. Vasquez Castaneda got process. He got the bond hearing and then the periodic reviews by his ICE detainers. And even these habeas proceedings provide Mr. Vasquez Castaneda some due process, reasoned the Fourth Circuit. As such, failing to even see a due process violation, the Fourth Circuit didn't conduct a Matthews balancing test. A simply devastating decision. If 4.5 years of civil confinement of an individual with apparently no criminal convictions makes you uncomfortable. And that is Vasquez Castaneda v. Perry et al. We are two cases in. Next is a matter of FCS, published by the BIA. This decision is about an issue that I had no idea was an issue. Mr. FCS is an asylum seeker, hence the acronym, and we'll call him the respondent. He's from El Salvador and sought asylum in removal proceedings. In those proceedings, the immigration judge set a call-up deadline for submission of evidence of April 7, 2023, 4 days before the scheduled merits hearing. Both the respondent and DHS met that deadline. But then the day before the merits hearing, the respondent filed a motion to accept an untimely filing with additional evidence. The IJ denied that motion, but put the late-filed evidence into the record for identification purposes only. That is, it wasn't considered substantively, but we in the BIA all know that it's there, officially. Quote, in support of his applications for relief, the respondent testified that members of the MS-13 gang confronted him because they believed a tattoo on his hand reflected allegiance to the rival 18th Street gang, end quote. Later, he was forced to strip so they could see his tattoos, and they ridiculed him based on his connection to his cousin, he believed. He fled to the U.S., and he also suffers from schizophrenia. The immigration judge denied everything, excluding that late-filed evidence, as I mentioned. And that's what this decision is really about. The asylum regulations were amended and went into effect at the end of May 2022. One of those regs is 8 CFR section 1240.17. I discussed this very briefly a while ago, but hadn't heard anything about it since, and now here we are. That reg allows asylum applicants submitted by individuals in expedited removal proceedings to be first adjudicated by USCIS. That is, people caught at or near the border or otherwise placed in expedited removal proceedings governed by INA Section 235 and who pass a credible fear interview get their application first decided by USCIS. They aren't necessarily just placed in removal proceedings before an IJ, as used to happen. If USCIS denies their application, they get removal proceedings, where an IJ gets to decide the application de novo. In essence, I believe it appears that these individuals get two bites at the asylum apple. 8 CFR section 1240.17 has many subsections, and that framework is just one of them. One of those subsections is subsection G. That reg states in pertinent part that, quote, the immigration judge shall exclude documentary evidence if the documentary evidence is not submitted by the applicable deadline, end quote. There are some exceptions not applicable here. But then under subsection K6, the restrictions on the consideration of late filed evidence in subsection G, quote, do not apply to a respondent who, quote, has exhibited indicia of mental incompetency, end quote. And the respondent here, of course, exhibits indicia of mental incompetency. Smart arguments for trying to get in late filed evidence. The problem for the respondent here, reasoned the BIA, is that he was not placed in expedited removal proceedings. He was just placed in removal proceedings, regular INA Section 240 proceedings. As such, the BIA ruled that his proceedings are not governed by 8 CFR Section 1240.17. The respondent was apparently caught near the border, and he was placed in expedited removal proceedings, and then he received a credible fear interview. All things that indicate that Section 1240.17 of the regulations governs. But vitally, an asylum officer found that he did not have a credible fear, meaning that USCIS never decided his asylum application. The only reason he wasn't then summarily removed is because he challenged that finding and an IJ overturned the asylum officer's no credible fear finding, thereby initiating removal proceedings. But to the BIA, that means that he was, quote, never placed in expedited removal proceedings, end quote. USCIS, of course, never adjudicated his asylum application, and it was never then referred to an IJ. It all simply began in immigration court because the IJ overturned the no credible fear finding. Or as the BIA lays out the rule, quote, the regulation at section 1240.17 applies only to those respondents placed in expedited removal proceedings whose applications for relief and protection were first adjudicated by USCIS and who were then placed in removal proceedings under section 240. It does not apply to those respondents placed in section 240 removal proceedings who were not first placed in expedited removal proceedings. That means the regulation doesn't apply and the evidence remains excluded. On the merits, then, asylum wasn't challenged before the BIA, but withholding of removal and cat protection was. Summarily dispensing with withholding of removal, the BIA believed that the respondent hadn't shown that anything that happened to him or that he fears was on account of a familial relationship, which might be a particular social group. Other than his testimony, quote, nothing in the record establishes that the gang members were targeting the respondent on account of his relation to his cousin, end quote. Jeez, I wonder what that excluded evidence was, right? Still getting a remand, though, back to the IJ. There are other particular social groups at play unmentioned, and the BIA isn't confident in the IJ's analysis or legal conclusions. Also, the BIA isn't actually sure what the IJ did with that late-filed evidence. The IJ said it was excluded, but then apparently mentioned it in the decision. Citing to INA Section 240C1A, the BIA states that, quote, excluded evidence or evidence marked for identification only should not be considered in resolving issues or adjudicating applications, end quote. And if it's actually considered, it must be admitted. The BIA also believes more CAT analysis required and appears to permit the submission of additional evidence on remand, so I guess that excluded evidence might be coming in. Who knows? But congrats on the remand, Stacy Tolchin, for respondent. I mean, I've got a thought. Maybe it's a reach. I don't know, maybe it's not. But while it's clear that someone like the respondent here now doesn't per se get the benefit of this new mental health exception to untimely filed evidence at 8 CFR section 1240.17 K6, the existence of this regulation sure does indicate a regulatory intent for DOJ that it believes that mental health concerns are important factors to consider when deciding whether to accept a filing or to accept some other deadline under the regular old good cause standard. Just a thought. And that is a matter of FCS. Moving on to the Second Circuit, with Wong v. Garland, published on March 11th, 2024. If you wanted the easy listening short podcast, this is not the one this week. Most of these decisions are long. This case is about convictions and CIMTs. And it's been a while, both on the issue and for the Second Circuit generally. It's an important decision, because this is the circuit petitioned for review of Matter of Wong, Episode 101, the BIA's precedential 2022 decision on this very issue. Will Matter of Wong become zombie precedent? It will not. Mr. Wong is from Hong Kong and has been a lawful permanent resident since 1979. He didn't naturalize. Unstated in the prior 2022 BIA decision, if I'm not mistaken, but the Second Circuit explains that Mr. Wong was convicted of importing heroin in 1988 and received a Section 212C waiver in likely deportation proceedings, thereby getting to keep his green card. Ah, former Section 212C. But he was placed back into removal proceedings in the 2000s, wherein, after some back and forth, an IJ and the BIA found him removable for having been convicted of two or more crimes involving moral turpitude, not arising out of the same scheme of criminal conduct. That's INA Section 237A2AII. The crimes were a disorderly person's theft by deception in violation of New Jersey statute annotated Section 2C:20-4 in 2005, and second-degree forgery in violation of New York Penal Law Section 170.10 in 2006. A lot of this all comes down to the definition of a criminal conviction for immigration purposes, and the INA is less than clear on that. INA Section 11A48A. Therefore, in its 2022 precedential decision, the BIA explained that to qualify as a criminal conviction, a, quote, criminal proceeding is one in which the accused is afforded minimum constitutional protections, which are applicable without limitation in all criminal prosecutions and without which criminal penalties cannot constitutionally be imposed, end quote. That is, there are many types of things and many types of procedures that states do to punish people, but not all of them can be deemed criminal convictions for immigration purposes. They need minimum constitutional protections, explained the BIA. And in Matter of Wong, the BIA said that those minimum constitutional protections were, quote, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and the rights to confront one's accusers, a speedy and public trial, notice of the accusations, compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in one's favor, and not to be put in double jeopardy twice for the same offense. End quote. If a state labels an offense criminal and doesn't include these protections, it would appear that it won't be a criminal conviction for immigration purposes. But on the flip side, if a state doesn't label an offense criminal, but it does include these protections for that non-criminal thing, it might be deemed a criminal conviction. At least that appears to be the case for the New Jersey disorderly persons offense here. In Matter of Wong, the BIA, quote, also explained that whether an accused is exposed to criminal penalties, as opposed to civil disabilities or disadvantages, is another focus of the Section 11A48A inquiry, end quote. Anyway, as you can gather, the BIA held that Mr. Wong's New Jersey disorderly persons offense, which I don't think is criminal under New Jersey law, met the test for being criminal under immigration law, and that the elements matched the definition of a CIMT. Same with the New York offense, because again, you need two CIMTs to be removable from within the United States if you've been an LPR for over 5 years. Here, applying the Chevron test that the Second Circuit recognizes might be vacated by the Supreme Court in 3 months, the court deferred to the BIA. It's really mostly about the New Jersey thing. We didn't just get here overnight. There are a lot of BIA decisions that lead to Matter of Wong. It's true, for example, and it remains the case, I think, that a third-degree theft violation in Oregon is not a criminal conviction, because as the BIA explained in Matter of Eslamazar, the Oregon violation, at least back then, required, quote, the lesser standard of a preponderance of the evidence, rather than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, end quote. So too, in Matter of Rivera-Valencia, the BIA held that, quote, a general court-martial is a criminal proceeding under the governing laws of the United States, resulting in the entry of a formal judgment of petitioner's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, end quote. So that's an important thing, whether the state framework requires a showing beyond a reasonable doubt of guilt, and apparently New Jersey requires that. Other BIA precedent before Matter of Wong weighed the rights the defendant had in these criminal adjacent proceedings. And here the BIA weighed all of this, as well as tried to resolve a somewhat circuit split on the issue, and came to the standard that I just described above at the beginning of this decision. That was all rational to the Second Circuit. After all, quote, uniformity in the enforcement of immigration laws was one of Congress's goals in passing the 1996 amendments to the INA, end quote, which also happened to, quote, broaden the definition of conviction, end quote. In so holding, the Second Circuit joined the Third Circuit in Avila v. Attorney General of the United States, Episode 177, that is, to deferring of Matter of Wong. That being said, the classification of an offense by a state is not irrelevant. Quote, IJs may still consider state classifications and criminal penalties to the extent that they shed light on whether constitutionally guaranteed criminal procedures are afforded for any given offense, end quote. But those state classifications, they just aren't dispositive. The New Jersey offense met the BIA's definition that the Second Circuit is now deferring to. The Second Circuit, though, also did not have a problem applying this new BIA definition to Mr. Wong's New Jersey offense, which by definition, right, occurred before the BIA issued its definition in Matter of Wong. Unlike the 11th Circuit last week, to determine the retroactive effect of a BIA decision, the Second Circuit believes a balancing test required. But the Second Circuit doesn't see the BIA's new definition as a crazy new rule or a clean break on precedent. Rather, the Second Circuit saw this more as a clarification and extension of its prior precedent, like Matter of Aslim Azar. Retroactive effect is therefore more likely to be okay in such circumstances as, quote, the BIA's decision was not an abrupt departure from well-established practice, but rather an attempt to fill a void in an unsettled area of law, end quote. And of course, the government has a strong interest in uniform application of immigration law. So, it's a retroactive new rule that is Matter of Wong. And the Third Circuit also apparently permitted Matter of Wong to be applied retroactively. Is it a CIMT? It is. That too, the CIMT definition is afforded Chevron deference because it's just so dang ambiguous. Dare I say, unconstitutionally so? And actually, Mr. Wong's in trouble here because he didn't argue the CIMT issue in his opening brief to the Second Circuit and instead put all of his eggs in the conviction basket. What a shame. No analysis from the Second Circuit because the issue was waived. As to the New York forgery conviction, where the conviction issue doesn't appear to be an issue, the Second Circuit agrees that that crime, too, is a crime involving moral turpitude. The statute requires an intent to defraud, deceive, or injure another and requires false conduct. And it's pretty well established that crimes that require intentionally fraudulent or false conduct will be CIMTs. Mr. Wong argued that intent to defraud is different from an intent to deceive or injure, as the statute requires, and that it makes a difference for CIMT purposes. But even if true, explained the Second Circuit, this criminal statute requires more. Remember, it's also about creating a false document. To the Second Circuit then, quote, it is difficult to imagine how the intent to deceive, coupled with the act of making or altering a written instrument, could not necessarily involve an intent to reap a benefit, cause a detriment, or impede government functions, end quote, which is sufficient to the Second Circuit to make it a CIMT. There are, though, unpublished Second Circuit decisions finding the intent to deceive or injure is insufficient in and of itself to make a crime a CIMT. So remember that, if a similar but not identical statute comes your way. Mr. Wong, therefore, is removable, and Matter of Wong remains good law. Before we go, my little quip about the CIMT definition being unconstitutionally vague or ambiguous was not appropriate, as the Second Circuit actually concludes by holding the CIMT definition is constitutional. And as I have often mentioned on the podcast, that argument was rejected by the Supreme Court like 70 years ago, so if it's going to win eventually, it's got to happen at the Supreme Court, it would appear. Wouldn't hurt to have a circuit split to get there, though, Second Circuit. And that is Wong v. Garland. Next is Chun Mendez v. Garland, published by the First Circuit on March 15th, 2024. The First Circuit gifted us a case about, ironically enough, late filings and particular social groups late on Friday Eve. Let's do it. Miss Chun Mendez and her child are from Guatemala. Also, she was found credible by the immigration judge. She is indigenous and of Mam descent. Her family has owned a house for generations, it seems. But she fled Guatemala in 2013 due to violence between her community and a neighboring municipality about land and water rights. I seem to recall a similar claim from Guatemala in a case recently. Here, members of the neighboring community would come by and fire guns at community members. Many community members were forced to flee. And when Miss Chun Mendez would flee and then return, she found that her family home was ransacked. She heard that neighbors who hadn't fled were murdered, so she eventually came to the United States and applied for asylum with her child. She claimed to have suffered and feared persecution based on her membership in the particular social groups of communal landowners of her town that refused to cooperate with criminal gangs, and two, her race as an indigenous woman of Mam descent. But she didn't file her asylum application within 1 year of entering the United States. She testified that she missed that somewhat arbitrary congressionally mandated deadline because, quote, she was suffering from headaches, nausea, and dizziness and became pregnant with her second child after her arrival, end quote. And she started attending therapy due to her experience in Guatemala a few months before she filed. Medical records confirm all of this, including an anxiety and major depression diagnosis. The immigration judge denied. After providing analysis, the IJ first concluded that her, quote, medical issues and child rearing did not amount to extraordinary circumstances that excused the late filing of her asylum application, end quote. Nor did the IJ believe that Ms. Chun Mendez had suffered past persecution. It was more generalized violence and strife. Nor did the IJ believe it was on account of any viable particular social group or that she had a well-founded fear of future persecution for the same reason. The BIA affirmed. And the First Circuit agreed. The asylum application was indeed untimely, by a few years. The INA does provide an exception based on a showing of, quote, either the existence of changed circumstances which materially affect the applicant's eligibility for asylum or extraordinary circumstances relating to the delay in filing an application, end quote. The regulations further elaborate that the circumstances can't be intentionally done through action or inaction, and that they must relate directly to missing the deadline, and that the delay must be reasonable then under the circumstances. And hey, at least the First Circuit didn't fault Ms. Chun Mendez for getting intentionally pregnant. Instead, it held that INA Section 208A3 divests it, the First Circuit, of jurisdiction to review the BIA's determination that the facts of a case don't amount to extraordinary circumstances to excuse the one-year filing deadline. The circuits lack jurisdiction to review such an issue unless a sufficient legal question is raised. Seems that it was not raised here. But in any event, the First Circuit dispensed with everything by jumping to the particular social group stuff. See, the agency didn't believe that Ms. Chun Mendez was even a member of the group, communal landowners of her town that refused to cooperate with criminal gangs, because she didn't actually own the land. Her grandmother did, I believe. And it doesn't appear that she owned it communally. Now, she later argued that her communal ownership, and thus membership in the group, was imputed upon her by those who sought to harm her, but she didn't make that argument to the IJ or the BIA, so the First Circuit deemed it unexhausted. Gotta make all your particular social group claims to the IJ. That's a matter of WYC and HOB. Quite the burden to place on immigration judges, but again, that's the rule the BIA has made, precedentially, and the one that we must follow. As to her race-based claim due to her mom ethnicity, well, the IJ considered those claims and denied them. Ms. Chun Mendez appears not to have challenged that denial at the BIA, so this too was unexhausted before the First Circuit. Meaning everything was denied largely as unexhausted. Bit of a strange case, but I'm a strange guy. And that is Chun Mendez v. Garland. Gonna do the Sixth Circuit before we take a break. Next is Vasquez Rivera v. Garland, published by the Sixth Circuit on March 15th, 2024. This case is about persecution from El Salvador. Ms. Vasquez Rivera is from El Salvador and was brought to the United States 10 years ago at 9 years old. So I guess she's 19 now. She was eventually released to live with her parents in Ohio and placed in removal proceedings. Her mother and her, then 13 years old, testified at her eventual hearing, and they said that she came to the United States in fear of gang violence in El Salvador. As it happened, the bus that she took to school was stopped by gangs one day, and the gang started extorting the bus driver. So she started walking to school with her uncle. But gang members started to try to force her uncle, Christian, to join the gang. Seems like this uncle was probably a child, too. The adults caring for Christian and Miss Vasquez Rivera got very worried, and quote, not unfounded, end quote, explains the Sixth Circuit, as gangs had murdered, shot at, and raped a litany of family members in the preceding years. Both Christian and Miss Vasquez Rivera were sent to the United States because of all of this. And the IJ believed her and her mother. The IJ just didn't believe that any of this had happened for the right reasons under asylum law, and so denied the claim. Similarly with Convention Against Torture Protection. The BIA affirmed. And while I don't usually note the judges at issue in these decisions unless they file a separate opinion, I do try to note trends. This decision is authored again by Judge Riedler. The same judge is the one who authored last week's, somewhat factually similar, decision out of the Sixth Circuit. And I kind of mentioned him last week, so I feel compelled to do so again. This time, however, the case is getting remanded. Not before the court agreed with the BIA in part. It agreed that three of Ms. Vasquez Rivera's proffered particular social groups are not, in fact, particular social groups. They're not socially distinct in El Salvador, said the court, which was, of course, the third particular social group element. For example, quote, the record as to country conditions shows merely that women and children in El Salvador generally suffer from criminality and mistreatment, including rape and child exploitation, offenses that the Salvadoran government does not effectively prosecute, end quote. No small country condition fact to recognize in and of itself by the Sixth Circuit, but also, it undermines that there's anything special, then, about the more nuanced female-based and child-based groups that Ms. Vasquez Rivera proposed. How about just the group of Salvadoran women, then, next time? Worth a shot. Always. Yes, there are laws to protect women in El Salvador, but the existence of such laws, at least here and at least by itself, doesn't satisfy social distinction to the BIA or the Sixth Circuit. Still one more group, though. Ms. Vasquez Rivera's family. The BIA seems to have assumed that her family was a valid particular social group, a decent assumption given recent case law, but just didn't believe that that family membership was one central reason for the gang's targeting of her and her fears. But remember, the BIA is an appeals court, and in most circumstances, is affirming or finding error with what the IJ did. Sometimes, though, in my experience, the BIA has had a tendency to, how shall I say it, reframe what an IJ found and then affirm that reframed finding. Well, if that happens in your case, remember this decision, because here, the Sixth Circuit faults the BIA for having, quote, attributed analysis to the IJ that the IJ never undertook, end quote, and then affirming that phantom analysis. That is, the IJ didn't believe the family a particular social group. That's what the IJ had found. The BIA, in contrast, assumed that it was, and held that there was no nexus to it. But that's a different analysis, and the BIA can't do that, said the Sixth Circuit. So it's getting remanded. But what nexus standard should the BIA apply on remand? Queried the court out loud. Asylum, as we all know, requires that a protected ground be one central reason, while the withholding of removal statute requires merely that the protected ground be a reason. And the Sixth Circuit is one of those circuits that has expressly recognized this distinction on nexuses. That's Guzman Vasquez v. Barr, dare I say it, from episode 4. Judge Riedler and I guess Judges Bush and Griffin on the panel don't seem quite convinced and would like the Sixth Circuit to go en banc on this issue. Quote, but for now, we remand to the BIA to apply circuit nexus precedent to Ms. Vasquez Rivera's asylum claim and claim for withholding of removal based on her membership and her family. End quote. Heads up in the Sixth Circuit, y'all. They're hunting for en banc review. The court affirmed the denial of cat protection, though, notwithstanding, quote, regrettable violence and crime in El Salvador, end quote. Still a remand, with some favorable findings to boot. So congratulations, Paul Grotus, for petitioner. And that is Vasquez Rivera v. Garland. Are you tired of answering your own phones or of wasting your valuable time on unqualified consultations? Staffy Live is the only 24/7 live receptionist and intake service specialized on immigration law. Staffy Live specialists are highly empathetic, bilingual individuals who know how to deal with adversity, have a background in client care, and are trained to qualify callers by asking the right questions. Staffy Live goes one step ahead in only scheduling qualified consultations on your calendar and then doing follow-ups when needed. Staffy Live is giving a 15-day free trial for any law firm interested with no strings attached. To apply, visit www.getstaffy.com. That's GETSTAFI.com. And click on Get Started. Make sure to put in the code FREE. Links, of course, in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by Driftwood Capital. Driftwood Capital boasts a 30-plus year track record, transacting on more than $3 billion in hospitality assets. Since 2015, Driftwood Capital has successfully implemented the EB-5 program into their development deals, helping more than 160 families find a secure path to residency through their projects. Driftwood Capital is a vertically integrated commercial real estate firm specializing in hospitality with dedicated acquisitions, development, lending, and management divisions. Their goal is to create long-term partnerships with its network of more than 1,200 active investors from the United States and abroad while targeting attractive returns. Driftwood's unique approach involves managing all aspects in-house, from developing renowned hotel brands such as Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt, to managing their portfolio of more than 80 hotels in the United States. If you want to learn more about Driftwood Capital, check out the show notes. And of course, let them know who sent you. Next is Guadarrama v. U.S. Attorney General, published by the 11th Circuit on March 15, 2024. What have we here? Matter of Guadarrama on direct petition for review. I've been waiting for you. But for better or for worse, the issue I've been waiting for is not what appears to be before the 11th Circuit here. This case is not about whether Mr. Guadarrama's Florida marijuana offense matches the federal definition of a controlled substance offense, or whether the 11th Circuit requires a realistic probability showing that Florida prosecutes possession of overbroad seeds and stems of marijuana. Hint, it does not. Nor is this case about whether the 11th Circuit's Ramos decision and realistic probability requirement, when the statute's text is overbroad, remains good law. Hint, Ramos remains good law. No. This case is about Mr. Guadarrama's application for and denial of an INA Section 212H waiver to waive inadmissibility in conjunction with an adjustment of status application that he filed in immigration court. This decision assumes that Mr. Guadarrama was inadmissible and needed a waiver due to the procedural posture below. This case is really about discretion. To cut to the chase, an IJ eventually said that even if Mr. Guadarrama was eligible, he hadn't established extreme hardship to a qualifying relative required for a Section 212H waiver, and that in any event, Mr. Guadarrama didn't warrant that waiver as a matter of discretion. The IJ emphasized Mr. Guadarrama's, quote, arrest for sexual battery, his conviction for contributing to the delinquency of a child, his multiple convictions for possession of marijuana and drug paraphernalia, the 5 years he spent as a fugitive in Georgia, and his failure to file tax returns, end quote. Tough case on discretion, as framed. And to be fair, there are substantial positive equities, too, apparently. The BIA affirmed all this, presumably by reviewing that discretionary determination de novo. End quote, because the BIA determined that Mr. Guadarrama didn't merit discretionary relief, it didn't reach the questions whether he needed a waiver or whether he met his burden regarding hardship, end quote. Adjustment of status is discretionary, remember. After the 11th Circuit's decision in Syed, episode 100, which made quite clear about what the 11th Circuit thinks about Florida marijuana offenses and the realistic probability test, Mr. Guadarrama moved to reconsider the denial of his applications. He argued, of course, that he was no longer inadmissible for the marijuana offense, and so he didn't need a waiver. He also argued that in any event, the BIA applied the wrong discretionary standard to his adjustment of status application the first time around. Under the 1970 decision Matter of Arai, there exists a, quote, presumption that the favorable exercise of discretion is appropriate for adjustment of status, end quote, applications. Unlike pretty much all other discretionary applications except maybe asylum. It's an oft-made argument based, if I'm not mistaken, on some of the final language in Matter of Arai. Haven't seen a circuit wrestle with this issue, though, at least since the podcast started. The BIA reaffirmed its denial on discretion, and here we are at the 11th Circuit. But to even bring such a claim, first, of course, you gotta get around the 11th Circuit's and Supreme Court's Patel decisions. Both adjustment of status and 212H waivers are expressly listed in the jurisdiction-stripping statute that was at issue in Patel. And that is what Mr. Guadarrama is seeking review of. And not that it matters so much, but he is literally seeking review of a discretionary decision. Doesn't seem good for jurisdiction. But, quote, an argument that the agency applied the wrong legal standard in making a determination constitutes a legal question, end quote. Even when the legal standard concerns discretion. And that is a big deal holding from none other than the Patel issuing 11th Circuit. They kind of said it in Ruiz too, that VAWA case from episode 160. Mr. Guadarrama, quote, isn't challenging the BIA's granular case-by-case balancing of the positive and negative equities in his particular case. Rather, he contends that the BIA applied the wrong framework altogether, end quote. That is, it should have applied the discretion standard for Matter of Arai for adjustment of status applications, rather than the other discretion standard articulated in Matter of Mendez-Morales and lots of other decisions. A pure legal question, said the 11th Circuit, and it can review it. But reviewing is, of course, different than winning. First, explained the 11th Circuit, in Matter of Arai, there was no Section 212H waiver at issue. It was a straight adjustment of status decision. Unsure whether that's the context here in this Guadarrama decision following Syed, but whatever, I guess we're assuming that a waiver was needed. In Arai, the BIA went on to explain that a balancing test was required to determine whether a non-citizen warranted adjustment of status as a matter of discretion, and then said, here's the kicker, quote, in the absence of adverse factors, adjustment will ordinarily be granted, still as a matter of discretion, end quote. Mendez-Morales, in contrast, did apparently involve a waiver of inadmissibility application. And the BIA apparently expressly said that the Arai approach had no role to play for such waivers. Mr. Guadarrama's reading of Arai is correct. The BIA did implement a bit of a non-citizen favorable presumption. So remember that. He is, quote, quite right that Mendez-Morales and Arai indicate that different legal standards apply in different circumstances, end quote. But to the 11th Circuit, where, as here, there are significant adverse factors, inadmissibility aside, the standards essentially merge. That presumption from Arai was, quote, in the absence of adverse factors, end quote. At a minimum, and again, expressly avoiding the inadmissibility or even conviction issues, the 11th Circuit again explains how Mr. Guadarrama had all those bad arrests. Even if we're talking only adjustment of status, and even if the presumption applies to such cases, Mr. Guadarrama's is not such a case. His is a normal balancing test because he's got these adverse factors. And so, believing that the BIA therefore applied the correct discretionary standard, the 11th Circuit can't then re-adjudicate how the BIA weighed that evidence. That's Patel and prior precedent. So Mr. Guadarrama lost. But not on the realistic probability test, everybody. Remember that for all time. And I do wonder. If Matter of Arai's presumption is limited only to situations where adverse factors don't exist, well, that's a rule that would completely swallow the presumption. humans being human, there's always some adverse factors present in a case, or at least very often. So what type of factors turn an awry discretion analysis into a mendes moralis? I don't see limiting principles in this 11th Circuit decision, but maybe there are some in awry itself. Give it another read. And that is Guadarrama v. U.S. Attorney General. We're almost done, but not quite. Two pretty big ones from the Ninth Circuit. First, Kalulu v. Garland, published by the Ninth on March 11th, 2024. This case is about credibility and asylum. Judge Sanchez concurred and dissented in part. Miss Kalulu is from Zambia, and the panel says she, quote, identifies as a lesbian, end quote. Homosexual activity is illegal in Zambia. She described three incidents of harm, and I'll get to them in a bit. She entered the U.S. on a tourist visa, quote, to attend a World Scouting Jamboree in West Virginia with her Zambian Girl Scout troop, end quote. And she stayed in California afterwards with her aunts for just under the six-month period permitted by her visa. Her visa was good for up to 3 years, although she could only remain in the U.S. at 6 months at a time, and so Ms. Kalulu went to Mexico briefly and tried to return and get another 6 months. Technically legal, but if border officers think that you intend to overstay or that you're really now living in the United States, they don't have to give you another 6 months, notwithstanding the fact that the visa is valid for 3 years. Which is what happened to Ms. Kalulu. Kind of. They actually sent her to secondary inspection and found a California public health benefits card, as well as WhatsApp messages about her babysitting for pay while she had been in California. Can't do or get either of those things with a tourist visa. Discovered in part because of all of these recent child pornography cases involving U.S. citizens at the border that have given border officers carte blanche to search cell phones at the border, including those of U.S. citizens, everybody. Rather than simply exclude her, DHS initiated removal proceedings. Ms. Kalulu applied for asylum in those proceedings, describing attacks that had occurred when the brothers of her girlfriend discovered their relationship in 2019. Ms. Kalulu, though, hadn't mentioned these fears at the border, the panel explains. An immigration judge deemed her not credible and denied all relief and protection. The BIA affirmed and also didn't believe the evidence independent of Ms. Kalulu's credibility established her claim. It went to the Ninth Circuit, which dove in deep. The Ninth Circuit majority affirmed the adverse credibility finding, explained the Ninth Circuit majority, quote, the IJ's adverse credibility determination, together with all the findings that fed into that determination, are subject to clear error review by the BIA, end quote. So I guess the logic goes, even if the BIA doesn't discuss a fact or two, if it affirms an IJ's adverse credibility finding, it's affirming the facts found by the IJ to get there. And the Real ID Act has made this review quite deferential, explained the Ninth Circuit. And defer the Ninth Circuit did. The IJ or the BIA, a bit unsure, apparently based the adverse credibility finding on 13 reasons. And not all of those reasons support an adverse credibility finding to the Ninth Circuit. Now this is just me. Under the Ninth Circuit's en banc Alam v. Garland decision, I would think that the adverse credibility finding therefore might fall. If a part of the adverse credibility finding is not correct, how can the adverse credibility finding be supported by substantial evidence in totality, as I believe Alam v. Garland and Bonk requires? That is the other massive week of cases from episode 72. To the Ninth Circuit majority, though, without any cite to that en banc decision, quote, once those unsupported reasons are disregarded, substantial evidence remains to support the agency's determination that Ms. Kalulu was not credible, end quote. There were at least five, explained the Ninth Circuit majority. First, Ms. Kalulu was apparently inconsistent as to when she made the decision to remain in the United States. Was it before she left Zambia or while she was here for that jamboree? Nor did she disclose a fear at her border interview, quote, the agency was not required to credit Ms. Kalulu's proffered explanation and disregard or discount the inconsistency, end quote. That is, that she was scared during the border interview. A reason that other circuits, and I believe another Ninth Circuit panel, have recognized recently as legitimate reasons to have less than perfect border interviews. Third, apparently non-verbatim report of that border interview indicated that Ms. Kalulu planned to attend a California college, but Ms. Galula testified that she never said that. The IJ was entitled not to believe her in-court testimony, said the Ninth Circuit. Fourth, apparently Ms. Galula has HIV and was inconsistent about when she started having health issues. Unsure what that has to do with her asylum claim, but the court believes it is an inconsistency. And finally, the record supports the IJ's finding that Ms. Kalulu's demeanor supported an adverse credibility finding, that is, that she was non-responsive at times to some of the immigration judge's questions. Always a difficult finding to get overturned on appeal. That she was consistent at other times is not overly important to the Ninth Circuit. Quote, an adverse credibility determination is not a balancing exercise. End quote. It is, however, a totality of the circumstances analysis. That's just me and the en banc court in Alam. Also to the Ninth Circuit, Ms. Kalulu was given a sufficient opportunity to explain these inconsistencies by the immigration judge. The majority begins its next section of the decision with the heading, quote, the dissent's reasoning largely tracks the unsuccessful arguments made by Ms. Kalulu and is therefore unconvincing for many of the same reasons, end quote. And here is where the Ninth Circuit talks about how adverse credibility findings must be made considering the totality of the circumstances. Something all three Ninth Circuit judges believe is, quote, undoubtedly true, end quote. The majority just sees it satisfied here for the reasons that I just explained above. Quote, once the agency catches a petitioner in some lies, the agency does not have to weigh those lies against all the other testimony where the agency couldn't tell if the petitioner was lying, end quote. I will stop to note the Universal Circuit agreement that adverse credibility doesn't necessarily mean lying, nor am I quite sure what lies the Ninth Circuit majority is referring to here. It's not really explained. Documents can sometimes be relevant, explained the court, even where inconsistencies exist. For example, quote, if documents prove that those statements found to be inconsistent are in fact consistent, then that would render the adverse credibility determination unsupported by substantial evidence, end quote. Remember it. Just not the case here. So the adverse credibility finding stands. I don't know. This decision seems to me kind of like a decision designed to narrow the en banc Alam decision without citing to Alam. But who knows? Lots of footnotes and about half of the majority opinion is directed at the dissent, and it seems a bit combative. Only the dissent cites to Alam, the most recent en banc Ninth Circuit adverse credibility decision. Nevertheless, the Ninth Circuit remanded. And that is because even though Ms. Kalulu was deemed not credible, the IJ and the BIA must determine whether the evidence independent of her credibility qualifies her for asylum and withholding of removal. A bit of a developing question that the Ninth Circuit takes as settled law, and I'm not going to argue with it. Because Ms. Kalulu did, after all, present eyewitness declarations of her attacks and medical evidence. The agency apparently misread and therefore misconstrued these documents, so the case is getting remanded. Not going to get into why, as it's quite nuanced and specific to the documents, but suffice it to say, the IJ misread and generalized from the documents a bit, and then believed them inconsistent with Ms. Kalula's testimony, when it was in fact the IJ's misunderstanding that created the inconsistency. Also, other documents that were apparently not properly stamped or sworn to were, in effect, stamped and sworn. So it's being sent back. And this is just me, but also, right, if she's a lesbian, that's pretty much illegal in Zambia. Which means, congratulations to Amelia M. Will and Judah Lacken, as well as certified law students Natalie Callis and Claire Weintraub from the University of California, Berkeley, for petitioner. Hard-fought partial win. And what did that dissent have to say, in his own words? Judge Sanchez said many things, like the majority, and of course agrees that remand is appropriate. Judge Sanchez disagrees on the adverse credibility stuff. Getting into the facts a bit more than the majority, Judge Sanchez explains the most egregious example to Judge Sanchez of the agency's error in reaching an adverse credibility finding. Apparently, the agency disbelieved Ms. Kalulu's claim, quote, that she is a lesbian because she had not visited gay clubs or participated openly in LGBT activities during her first 5 months in the United States, end quote. This amounts to impermissible, quote, dubious stereotyping, end quote. Judge Sanchez highlights that many of the 13 adverse credibility reasons were deemed improper by the Ninth Circuit panel here. And I wrote a lot more, but this week then became uber long. So just to conclude, aligning then with my understanding of the binding en banc Alam decision, Judge Sanchez writes that, quote, the Real ID Act and our precedents therefore require that we remand for the agency to determine in the first instance whether the remaining inconsistencies are sufficient under a totality of the circumstances to support an adverse credibility finding, end quote. And that is Kalulu v. Garland. If you've made it with me this long, you're the real MVP. We conclude with United States v. Orozco Orozco, published by the Ninth Circuit on March 12, 2024. This case is about theft-type aggravated felonies. And it comes to us in the unique procedural posture of an illegal reentry conviction defended by the San Diego Public Defenders, the finest federal public defenders in Southern California, if I do say so myself. Mr. Orozco is from Mexico and was brought to the United States without authorization at 10 years old. At 20 years old, in 2005, he was convicted of felony carjacking under California Penal Code Section 215. He eventually served 3 years in prison, and while in prison, ICE issued a final order of removal against him. No immigration judge or anything. ICE can do this under a little discussed but kind of crazy provision of the INA that permits ICE itself to determine that a conviction is an aggravated felony and then remove the non-citizen without review by an IJ. INA Section 238B. Made easier by the fact that Mr. Orozco didn't contest it and didn't indicate a desire for immigration relief. Later, Mr. Orozco attested that he didn't understand English or what was happening, but he believed that he had no choice but to sign the paperwork from prison. ICE believed that the carjacking offense was a crime of violence under INA Section 101A43F and removed Mr. Orozco to Mexico. He made two later attempts to re-enter unlawfully, and he was deported each time. On his third attempt in 2021, DOJ prosecuted him criminally for doing so. With the help of the San Diego Public Defender's Office, Mr. Orozco moved to dismiss this Section 1326 criminal illegal reentry after removal charge, arguing that the carjacking crime was not a crime of violence, making the 2013 final order of removal from ICE an improper basis to underlie his 1326 conviction. DOJ conceded this in criminal proceedings, likely because of Sessions v. DiMaia or some other Supreme Court or Ninth Circuit crime of violence precedent, but this decision does not say. Either because it believed its argument foreclosed or for strategic reasons, the government pivoted and said, fine, maybe it's not a crime of violence, but it is a theft-type aggravated felony under INA Section 11843G. The district court agreed, denied Mr. Orozco's motion to dismiss, and Mr. Orozco then entered a conditional guilty plea. Conditional on this appeal, that is, booyah. The Ninth Circuit reversed. I'm not going to get into all the things required to collaterally attack a removal order in Section 1326 criminal proceedings because it's complicated and it's pretty much entirely criminal law specific, but suffice it to say, showing that the underlying removal order was, quote, fundamentally unfair, unquote, might get the job done. And that in turn turned on whether the California Section 215 carjacking conviction is an INA Section 11843G aggravated felony. The conviction had the one-year term of imprisonment as that aggravated felony requires, so that's one element down for the government. The rest, however, turns on the categorical approach, and here is where the prosecution floundered, said the Ninth Circuit, albeit without using such a fishy verb. Second aquatic pun of the episode, if you're counting. Need to compare the elements of the federal theft offense to the elements of the California offense. Quote, a generic theft offense is a taking of property or an exercise of control over property without consent, with the criminal intent to deprive the owner of rights and benefits of ownership, even if such deprivation is less than total or permanent, end quote. Theft stems from common law larceny, so larceny definitions have also helped the Ninth Circuit define generic theft for aggravated felony purposes. For example, to meet the definition, a crime must be, quote, felonious, which is a common law term of art meaning intent to steal, end quote. That, in turn, requires that the, quote, defendant intend to deprive the victim of possession of property without a superior possessory interest to that of the victim, end quote. That is, the federal theft definition does not require a showing that the victim owned the property. But there must be a showing that, quote, the defendant had the intent to deprive the owner of the rights and the benefits of ownership, end quote. So there, that's the federal definition that we're working with. Doesn't matter what actually happened in Mr. Orozco's offense. And therefore, it doesn't matter that California state courts don't require a showing that the victim owned the car to convict under Section 215, because again, that's not an element of generic theft, said the Ninth Circuit. What does matter, however, is that in the 2004 decision People v. Montoya, the California Supreme Court held that, quote, a person can commit a carjacking without necessarily committing an unlawful taking of a vehicle, because carjacking requires the intent to deprive the driver of possession, and the driver may or may not be the owner. Pretty important, because the federal definition of a theft offense requires, quote, that the defendant had the intent to deprive the owner of the rights and benefits of ownership, end quote. To explain this point, the California Supreme Court in Montoya gave a hypothetical. Joe knows that his neighbor Mary's car has been stolen and that she is offering a reward for its return. If Joe spots an unfamiliar person driving Mary's car and orders that person out at gunpoint and then drives off, intending to return the car to Mary and secure the reward, he would be guilty of carjacking, but not of an unlawful taking of a vehicle. The California Supreme Court gave us that hypothetical, and it did so in part to permit more convictions for the same conduct. This reading of carjacking means that someone can be convicted in California of both carjacking and the unlawful taking of a vehicle, and therefore can be punished with more time in prison, without implicating constitutional double jeopardy concerns. But the flip side of it is that the California Supreme Court took out an element necessary to make carjacking an aggravated felony theft offense. Under this hypothetical, to which the Ninth Circuit is essentially bound when it comes to the elements of California state law, quote, carjacking does not require generic theft's specific intent to steal, end quote. California state courts have actually applied the statute in such a way multiple times. The Ninth Circuit string cites and analyzes those cases. So two California jury instructions support this reading of the statute as being overbroad vis-a-vis the federal definition of a theft offense. So there you go. But before all of us crimmigration practitioners celebrate too much in California, this may be unique to carjacking. There are other Ninth Circuit decisions that have held otherwise for other theft-type statutes, and Section 215 carjacking seems, quote, different, because the California Supreme Court made clear in Montoya that Section 215 carjacking can be committed without a specific intent to steal, end quote. But hey, take the win, right? Also means Mr. Orozco might not be able to be convicted for his illegal reentry. A few more criminal-specific factual inquiries must be done on remand. And of course, whether he gets to stay under immigration law is another matter entirely, requiring a local San Diego immigration attorney who knows all about crimmigration, such as yours truly. Thanks for the great work, San Diego Federal Public Defenders. And that is United States v. Orozco, Orozco. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, or send us a tweet at imreview. That's I-M-M review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review. Thank you.